Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 78 at the very beginning, which is old single column page 868. Okay. I've been hinting at it coming for a while now. We're finally there. We're finally past the immediacies of Adam and Eve, including sort of the corollary story of Adamson. So we have Adamites and we have Adamsonites, and we're now ready to tell the story of those peoples, how they spread out and engage the rest of the world over all of the millennia up to the beginning of recorded time. And obviously, when we start out the story, we have relatively pure Adamites and Adamsonites, but you know, it doesn't take long, and what comes naturally happens, and there's intermating. Obviously, the Noddites, we've already seen the beginning of that with Adamson marrying Rada, and beginning that process of blending the Adamites and the Noddites together. But her being a pure line Noddite, which is so similar to an Adamite, you basically ignore that little detail to begin with, and you can think of the Adamsonites as being very much like the pure Adamites. So you're starting with that purity, a genetic purity, and then slowly you're going to start to mate with the already blended in with the evolutionary stock Noddites, and then also the evolutionary stocks themselves. Obviously, the primary Sangiks are going to be a more immediate modality of the Adamites engaging the Sangic races, and we've already seen them mentioning that with the blue race, with that that child that brought Adam in with Eve, in doing the deed. So they're going to, as they begin to tell us the story of those pure peoples establishing their domains of existence and spreading out from there, they need to give us a little thumbnail sketch that they'll do in this first section of what's out there. They want to remind us, kind of harken back. We've talked about the Sangiks, but it's been a while now. For instance, so they're going to give us a little thumbnail sketch again about, over the last 500,000 years, where have the Sangiks migrated? How much have they blended? How have they displaced the pre-existing Andonites? It's obviously going to be a tendency for the Sangiks to be shoving the Andonites to the margins, and so they'll mention that. So we need to get the basic picture laid out, and then they'll start telling the story of specifically how those migrations played out. Okay, so let's just jump in, see what they've got here.
Paper 78, The Violet Race After the Days of Adam. The second Eden was the cradle of civilization for almost 30,000 years. Here in Mesopotamia, the Adamic peoples held forth, sending out their progeny to the ends of the earth, and laterally, as amalgamated with the Noddite and Sangic tribes, were known as the Andites. From this region went those men and women who initiated the doings of historic times, and who have so enormously accelerated cultural progress on Urantia.
Okay, so so that idea, see, of the second Eden being the cradle of civilization for almost 30,000 years. So think about where we're starting our story again. Remember, in terms of, you know, and one of the things you'll notice, we won't just talk in terms of how many years ago, like we so often do. We'll actually start to talk about such and so BC now, you know, much more frequently. And we'll have a blend of the two to begin with. But Adam and Eve, in terms of BC, arrived 35,915 BC. Okay. So when they say almost 30,000 years, right, where does that put you? Yeah, that puts you basically at 6,000 BC, right, the beginning of recorded history. So, you know, they don't say it directly there, but see, between the lines, that's what they're, you know, that's what they're saying. They're going to tell that story from immediate wake that we now have, like I said, of Adam and Eve, all the way forward to the beginning of recorded history, roughly 6,000 BC. And they'll, you know, bring it up specifically a number of times, what they're mentioning there. They hold a significant collection of themselves there in Mesopotamia for a very, very, very long time. I mean, basically the whole time. You know, they don't, you know, so they try to do, in essence, what they know they were supposed to do, to not immediately go out, you know, the handful they have to begin with, and go out and blend in and then lose it. You know, they keep themselves as integrous as possible for as long as possible, right there between the rivers, and you know, and they send out, but they keep the source relatively pure, so that you have an ongoing uplift from a relatively consistent source, as opposed to an ever degrading source and diminishing returns. Okay, that held forth. They had to take a definitive stand against blending in. Let's see. And we'll get into that, the specifics of what an Andite is. They're mentioning that up front. So just the initial degree of blending. So they're not fully blended in. They're kind of halfway between, in genetic terms, between pure Adamites and the Sangic peoples. You've got these significantly, relative to our current genetics, upstepped peoples. I mean, there isn't anyone on the planet that has the height of genetic nature that the Andites had. You know, so they're cut above anything alive, no matter how much Adamic blood you might find in someone alive today. Andites are definitively a cut above that.
This is the first time I've noticed referring to the Andites. We're known as. That indicates that it's a historic term, not a coined term.
I did some digging one time, and I did. You've got references to people in some ancient inscriptions that they really don't know anything about them except, you know, on this stone, there's all these different peoples listed. Obviously, you're not dealing with something that's written in Latin letters, you know, you're looking at, you know, it might be in cuneiform or whatever, but I actually found an example of a people that the scholars, translate, can't even really say transliterate if it's kind of not coming from something that's, you know, a similar language. But translate into that sequence of Latin letters, A-N-D-I-T-E. At the very least, the revelators are saying, okay, those people that you found a reference to, you know, it may be the case that they're much more blended than the actual Andites we're talking about here, but they may be kind of the tail end of that, and they went ahead and just sort of generalized and back used that name. It would be kind of like instead of calling them Nodites, calling them Sumerians, right? You know, to take a name that we have historically, you know, and extend it backwards. I don't know. I mean, they don't give you any hint. I mean, you know, A-N-D, and then, I mean, was there someone named A-N-D at some point? Or something, you know, where they chopped off the end, you know, and its root is A, you know, someone's name, root of their name is A-N-D, and then, you know, you're making it the people relative to that individual by adding the ite. I don't know. They don't explain in the Urantia book. And I think it's probably because of what you're suspecting there, just by the way it's said, that it's, they're using that and that historical, very slight, but nonetheless historical name that we have. I mean, you're not going to Google Andite and find this. You know, it's not a Wikipedia page for Andites. Right. But anyway, you got that name that the revelators have decided to use for all those peoples that were a cut above the genetics of what we have now, but not full pure Adamite. Let's see, what else do we have there? And you can see they kind of gave you the hint by, from this region went those men and women who initiated the doings of historic times. Giving you that hint that they're taking you up to roughly 6,000 BC. Okay, what else do they say here in this preface?
This paper depicts the planetary history of the Violet Race, beginning soon after the default of Adam, about 35,000 BC, and extending down through its amalgamation with the Nodite and Sangic races, about 15,000 BC, to form the Andite peoples, and on to its final disappearance from the Mesopotamian homelands, about 2,000 BC.
Okay, so You penetrate a little bit into, you know, historical times to fully explain what we have there between the rivers in those oldest historical times. You know, so you see here that they actually, you know, give you all the way to 2000 BC. But probably the more immediate thing to note when they say that, in other words, they're basically taking you from Adam and Eve up to Melchizedek. Because what BC, you know, what year BC was it when Machaventa it was incarnated? 1980 BC. Right? You have two big blocks of papers in the book. You have Adam and Eve and all that extended from Adam and Eve, and then you have Machiavelli and Melchizedek and all that extended from him. See, so there's, you know, they're giving you those blocks, you know, between epical revelations. Okay.
The violet race,
mm-hmm.
and that's a title. Do you think what did they look like? Did they had a violet hue?
No.
It seems like they're pretty much works, and they've gone by 2000 BC. There's probably any of them left.
Yeah, it's important. Yeah, to just
because they do talk about the red man, other races.
Right. So you know you have the violet race is. That designation is different than the designation for the Sangic races. And obviously the Sangic races, it's literally talking about skin pigment, but not with the violet race. You know, if you want to think about it beyond just the immediacy of, okay, so with the Sangics, it's a skin color. You know, Adam and Eve glowed in the dark. Their children didn't.
Hue.
Right, with the violet hue. You know, and they're just extending that. Okay, if you want to think about it beyond that, you know, which you should, because, right, it's not a coincidence, you know, that this non-pigment color is the next color, right, in the spectrum, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet, right? So think about how that worked. You know that we've been struggling with trying to understand how you think about the physical nature of a secondary midwayer, as we've been talking about the midwayers in the preceding paper. All this confusing stuff about it's like, well, okay, exactly, you know. Okay, are they corporeal or not? And it's like, well, they have to have all the atoms and stuff that we do because they can make themselves manifest just like we do. And okay, but there's this transcendence of their energy. Remember when last time we were talking about it, you know, to think about it as a downstepping of energy until you have it downstep to what we call the molecular level and you can touch it, like you can touch the arm of the couch. So here in this case is another example of that. You have those colors, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. With the Sangics, those six colors, they're downstepped all the way to where the colors are literally made flesh, if you will, right? They're literal pigment. The violet color is not downstepped that far. Right, but it's there in that high energy interaction between that high level of mechanical mind and the body. Right, it's just that it's not downstepped to the point where it's literally solidified as a skin tone.
What do you think their skin tone was?
So they're so in terms of their skin tone, they just have very light skin.
Very light skin.
Yeah, and so when they're when you think about them mating, they're going to be diluting the coloring of whatever Sangic they're mating with. And so if you start with Blue Man and you blend in a little bit of red and yellow, which is what you got, that went to Northern Europe. So you take a primary Sangic blend like that that's basically brown. And then you dilute it out, right? And you get the northern white race, right? With some individuals that will display a little bit of yellow to their northern white race pigment, or lack of pigment, or a little red, like me, but basically, you have a fairly neutral color to begin with, right? That's then diluted to be, very, 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 very light brown, i.e., the white race. Okay.
It finally disappeared in 2,000 years. Was that just because it just diluted out?
So the deal there in the Mesopotamian homelands, they're not only diluting out, but you eventually have the Babylonians coming in and taking over, right, in between the rivers. You know, that's also, you know, roughly the beginning of what you would call Babylonia, between the rivers, you know, and in contrast to the pre-existing Sumeria phenomenon in the far south, and this phenomenon, you know, that we don't fully appreciate historically, you know, a little to the north, you know, the remnants of the Second Garden. But again, you know, long, you know, by the time you get to 6,000 BC, not to mention 2,000 BC, you don't have any pure Adamites anymore, right? It's all blended. I mean, you basically have, you know, those Sumerians or, you know, that one, Chaldeans almost, right? I mean, getting to that, you know, point. You know, it's, you know, there's going to be all kinds of Sangic blended in and whatnot there. But so it's not so much genetic at the very end, but cultural. I see, and that's what the final disappearance is. You know, what's finally disappearing is really the culture as opposed to the genetics. Okay, you know, as you can see there, they're giving you that hint that, I mean, you really didn't have any Adamites anymore by 15,000 BC. What you had at best was an Andite at 15,000 BC. Yeah, at best, right? You know, it had blended so that, you know, at best you had an Andite. Okay, let's see, anything else there? Let's see, so again, like just to remind you that, you know, we're going to be going through this set of papers that is a precursor to us eventually getting to Machiavelli and Melchizedek and then doing likewise when the Melchizedek missionaries go out. Yes, you have the Sethite priesthood going out at the same time you have this dispersion. But the big story here is not so much that. You know, it's a biologic dispersion that's the primary story here. Whereas when Melchizedek, it's a religious evangelizing that's going out. Okay.
Here's a question.
Oh, a question? Yep.
Well, John Stevens would like to share a comment. He said this is having to do with the etymology of the word Andite.
Mm-hmm.
An equals one, dite equals small oneness or unity.
Yeah, but again, you got to remember that the you have to separate A-N-D and I-T-E. The I-T-E is the suffix. You know, like for instance, like I said, I mean, there's on that stone where where you can see, I mean, there's nothing. There's no A, there's no N, there's no D, there's no I-T-E. I mean, you know, it's, like I said, it's in some ancient language, okay, and they're Latinizing it. You know, so what they're doing is they're taking what's there and they're Latinizing it as A-N-D, and then they're just adding ite, you know, the English suffix to indicate the people tied to whatever that nuclear fact is, whether it's someone's name or some place or, you know, some concept. I mean, whatever the heck it is, right, that's the nuclear concept, right? You're just making it the people tied to that nuclear fact by adding the ite, right? The scholars are adding the ite, right? There's nothing, you know.
It's
yeah.
Kind of confusing. So, close to Andite.
Right. And it's right.
Mixed up in your talk.
Yeah. See, and that just the fact that it's so close to Andite, kind of adds to the fact that probably they were kind of forced into using that Andite. I mean, if they coined something themselves, they probably wouldn't have coined it so confusingly similar. Right. But again, if remember, they're told if there's anything that humans have, right, even if it only exists one time, you know, on one stone that you've found, right, and you have no idea who the people are or anything, right, if you have something that it can remotely be used, they have to do that. Right? You know, that's their mandate. So, you know, I think probably, you know, they were sort of forced to use that term. I mean, it does have the advantage of it starts with A, like Adamite, so it reminds you of a closeness. But it also is confusing because it reminds you of Andonite. But of course, that's not all that bad because you have the upstepped Andonite genetics in the prince's staff, and the Nodites are an important part of this. So that's not a, you know, that's not inappropriate either. Okay. So now, like I said, we're gonna in section one here. We're gonna get this little thumbnail sketch of what the lay of the land is on the planet that the Adamites are diffusing out into.
Section one, racial and cultural distribution. Although the minds and morals of the races were at a low level at the time of Adam's arrival, physical evolution had gone on quite unaffected by the exigencies of the Caligastia Rebellion. Adam's contribution to the biologic status of the races, notwithstanding the partial failure of the undertaking, enormously upstepped the people of Urantia.
Okay, we've mentioned this before, but I want to remind you of that fact. Two things that biologic evolution doesn't care about rebellions. That's irrelevant. It just kept right on evolving up till about 40,000 years ago when it reached its apex. That's why the life carriers called for an Adam and Eve and why we got one. And then, you know, even though the default left us with just this tiny little group on the planet, you know, we've seen this before. They don't hold back. They use very strong language, enormously upstepped, to just try to get us to not take for granted what we've got right now genetically. Sure, relative to Havona natives, we're primitive, okay, but there's primitive and there's primitive.
Right, yeah. Real.
Right, right. Just imagine what the world would be like if we didn't have some Adamic uplift. Right? It's what they're trying to get you to stress. And then underlying that is the extreme absurdity of thinking that something this relatively fancy could just bubble up out of the mud, right? That we're just this accident thing, right? To try to get us to recognize that, you know, just how sophisticated we are relative to a quartz crystal, right, or something, right? To really focus in on, no matter how small it is in some people on the planet, to focus in on how the Adamic genetics shines a spotlight on your human nucleus, right? Forget about all of the lesser aspects of you or anyone else on the planet, right? And try to just focus in on what that Adamic upstep was trying to grab a hold of and lift up out of the noise of the evolutionary product, right? You'll find the person there, right, as opposed to the fancy animal, right? And if you can tune your eye well like that, the human in each of us won't be such a still small voice. Yeah, enormously upstep. They're trying to point out that if you have insight, it's very clear. And that when Jesus was engaging humans, he was focusing just on that clear, differentiated human nugget. Right? And was ignoring the not so human, right, detritus that we all carry around. And so to think of Adamic blood as kind of a lens, right, that focuses your human nature, that brings your personality to a focus. Because of course, what it does is most literally, immediately, biologically, is upsteps to say how much the seventh adjutant engages you. All right, and in the hourglass analogy, with the seventh adjutant in the neck. Right, put a lens there, right, and bring the upper domain through that lens have a focused impact on the lower domain. Right? Think of what they do is bring your personalized self of spiritualized mind into a focused enlightenment of your adjutant animal origin nature. Right? That's you know, it's literally what the Adamic genetics does. Okay. I guess we got everything. Yep, keep going here.
Adam and Eve also contributed much that was of value to the social, moral, and intellectual progress of mankind. Civilization was immensely quickened by the presence of their offspring. But 35,000 years ago, the world at large possessed little culture. Certain centers of civilization existed here and there, but most of Urantia languished in savagery. Racial and cultural distribution was as follows.
Okay, so before we go into the list, there you see they're mentioning what I was saying in the preface. You don't just have the biologic influence. You do have a social, cultural, civilizational influence as well. And that can last even when the genetics is washed into the background, as the Sumerians so definitively demonstrate. Where did this sophisticated, culture come from? These civilizational concepts come from, that they have. When everyone else around them, is thinking, maybe we could do something fancier than picking berries, for a living. As a hunter-gatherer. That cultural influence, very strong. Remember, we'll get to how strong it was with that little pocket of Andites that went across the Pacific to South America. Right? Really, the genetic influence was negligible, basically. But the cultural was, huge. Thousands and thousands and thousands of years later, it was still having this radical effect on South and Central America. So we go there and find Mayans and stuff like we do, right? Okay, now the other thing in there is, why are they saying 35,000 years ago? You're going, well, are they just being very fuzzy? I mean, we saw up in the preface, I didn't highlight this because I'd mentioned it before, but I should bring it up, I guess. Like I said, Adam and Eve were at 35,915 BC is when they arrived. Okay, Adam lived to be 530. That doesn't get us to 35,000. They're just, when they bring up 35,000, that's just sort of, okay, all the initial fall to roll is over, and that's a nice clean starting point, to go forward for 35,000 BC. Did someone goof? Did they mean 35,000 BC instead of 35,000 years ago? Or are they being even more hand-wavy about it, ballparking it, or what's going on there? The answer is no, okay? When they say 35,000 years ago, there's something they've told you, it's been quite a while since we read it, that they said was precisely 35,000 years ago. And if you go back to the end of paper 61, you don't have to do it. It says 35,000 years ago marks the termination of the Great Ice Age, excepting in the polar regions of the planet. Remember, we went through the whole historical geology. You got all those dates on all the paragraphs. The final one is 35,000 years ago. Okay. What they're saying is, what's the world like? When the Ice Age, had ended, except in the polar regions. It still hasn't ended there even today.
It's ending quickly.
So that's when they want to give you this thumbnail sketch. So you finally have basically gotten rid of the ice off of the places where you would want to have people distributed. Okay, and most of there's been a lot of ocean rise already, but you do have some, you know, you would be in the final stages of the oceans rising as all that ice melted. You know, and remember, talking about massive, right, increase in ocean level relative to anything you can imagine today. There's been a lot of very, very radical change, but there's, relative to these days, there's still sort of the final radical changes that have to go on, because we've sort of just gotten to the end. You got to keep that in mind as you read this in order to properly interpret it. That's what they're saying, right? So end of the ice age. What's the state of affairs? Okay, so let's do number one here.
Number one, the violet race, Adamites and Adamsonites. The chief center of Adamite culture was in the second garden, located in the triangle of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. This was indeed the cradle of Occidental and Indian civilizations. The secondary, or northern center of the violet race, was the Adamsonite headquarters, situated east of the southern shore of the Caspian Sea, near the Kopet Mountains. From these two centers, there went forth to the surrounding lands the culture and life plasm which so immediately quickened all the races.
So there you see it very directly. They're lumping the Adamsonites into the violet race. Like I said, it's Rada's so close to an Adamite that the difference is not important here. You have very directly there, right, if it wasn't already obvious, that what we call Indo-European, right, is predicated on the Adamites, more immediately predicated on the Andites, right? It's that Andite genetics and what that genetics leads to naturally for a language, right, that establishes the Indo-European foundation of languages. And anything outside of Indo-European has to, you know, has to do with the Andonites or something. And a red man or a blue man or, right, whatnot. Okay, so, that's, if you ever wondered, why is there this vast sweeping Indo-European fact of languages? It's because of the Andites, who aggressively went out and established a vast domain where that they dominated language-wise.
Of all the words they chose, the quickened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the reason they said quickened there is to give that immediate paragraph. Like, well, is that like those spiritual quickening events? Yes, very much. Like I was just saying, you've had enough seventh adjutant to sort of directly note it in the name Homo sapien since the Sangiks. Okay. But we're now going to double down on that and have an influence that leads to Homo sapien sapien, right? That designation we use, you're going to very much accentuate the seventh adjutant, that wisdom potential, which... increases your access to, your relationship to the Holy Spirit, a spiritual quickening. Okay, so like I said, that's the important thing, not the dilution of skin color or increased angular features or whatever else you want to think of, more blue eyes or right. It's that mindal upstep, and hence a greater spiritualized mind in the Holy Spirit sense of spiritualized. You're going to have beings with more innate insight and foresight, more sagacity. You know, and that greater sagacity leads to greater wisdom. So you can begin to think about that triplet of wisdom, insight, and foresight. Which is one of the things we kind of end with when we get through this whole arc on the people stemming from Adam and Eve. Okay, let's see. Anything else we have there? Let's see. Yeah, we know about the by the Copet Mountains. We talked about that with the Adamsonites. Let's see. I think we got everything there. Oh yeah. The triangle. You know, like we've pointed out. Remember again, you got the where the two rivers come close together. So that's you know the point of the triangle. All right, and then a little bit down from that, because all the way down is where those pre-Sumerian Nadites are. Right? The second garden is just that little triangular region at the point of the close neck of the Tigris and Euphrates. All right, speaking of pre-Sumerian.
Number two, pre-Sumerians and other Nadites. There were also present in Mesopotamia, near the mouth of the rivers, remnants of the ancient culture of the days of Dalmatia. With the passing millenniums, this group became thoroughly admixed with the Adamites to the north, but they never entirely lost their Nadite traditions. Various other Nadite groups that had settled in the Levant were, in general, absorbed by the later expanding Violet race.
Okay, so... As we talked about before, right, you still have, you know, all the way up to the Babylonians, you still have that differential down there in the southern part of, you know, between the rivers. But these pre-Sumerians, you know, into Sumerians, into Chaldeans. And those other Nadites that we talked about in the, the preceding paper, like you're saying, they don't have such an enduring cultural influence. They get blended in, and you know, in relatively short order. And again, just reminds you of how strong their the Nadites' identification was to the land between the rivers. They held on to that religiously. And seeing those that geographically left didn't hold on to it so religiously. Those that stayed, you know, they had a white-knuckle grip on their cultures, you know, until their dying breath. Okay. Let's see, anything else there? Let's go to the next block.
Number three. The Andonites maintained five or six fairly representative settlements to the north and east of the Adamson headquarters. They were also scattered throughout Turkestan, while isolated islands of them persisted throughout Eurasia, especially in mountainous regions. These aborigines still held the northlands of the Eurasian continent, together with Iceland and Greenland, but they had long since been driven from the plains of Europe by the Blue Man and from the river valleys of farther Asia by the expanding yellow race.
Okay, so like I was saying, see, the Andonites get geographically marginalized. Other than, you know, kind of having their turf in Turkestan there, every place else they're, you know, either driven up into the less desirable higher elevations, or you know, they're shoved to the higher latitudes, and so you know they by and large they end up kind of being a people of colder regions. At least way back in those days when they were being so aggressively shoved around by the Sangiks.
How do you think they got to Iceland?
You know,
were they different?
No, I mean, way back you could, you know, there's some, you know, we talked about that. There's been so much change, you know, not to mention, remember, you take the oceans way down when the ice is up and, you know, there's lots of land that isn't there now, you know, and I think you know how shallow a lot of that stuff is around Iceland and stuff, relative.
Like the Bering Straits, you mean, that kind of thing?
Yeah, like the Bering Straits and, yeah, so many things were, you know, were above water, you know, way back when the ocean was so much lower, not to mention all the changes because of plate tectonics and earthquakes and whatnot, you know. But
that wasn't that long ago.
Right, it wasn't. Yeah, and that's one of the things we're going to get to, just how recently some of these dramatic changes happened because of the ice melting. That's kind of coming up. Like, so I emphasized it up front. We've got a biggie about that coming up here shortly. Yeah. you know, and that's not, you know, that's not appreciated, just how recently things were radically different. We forget how much ice there was and how much the ocean went up. So, you know, not to mention how much things moved because of plate tectonic activity, you know, vertically shoved up and down and whatnot.
It doesn't take much to get us excited.
Yeah, and again, the reason that we're so ignorant about that is, like we've just mentioned, recorded history begins at 6,000 BC. I mean, we have such a parochial concept, right, from our recorded history.
I think a lot of it goes back to what you said a few minutes ago. The people I know who are so, upset about it or whatever, aren't really thinking about it.
Yeah.
They're not really using the wisdom. Yeah. And maybe they don't, because we have it and they don't, I don't know, but the knowledge. But, you know, it's very six-edged, very zealous, very emotional, very, you know, gosh, the world's coming to an end, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I heard a very, let's give you a sidetrack here, yeah. Something interesting. I heard a very interesting comment from some scientist who works over here. You probably knew him, forget his name. Was telling me, he says, well, you know, I think what reason that things are getting warmer and, the you know, everything's melting has to do with the fact that our solar system is passing through a different part of space that doesn't have anywhere near as much dirt or dust in it, and therefore the sun's rays are reaching, and that's kind of an interesting thought.
Yeah, well, remember that was a fascinating thing we saw when they were in the book, that they point out that those stories have some
true, yeah.
Some historical predicate to them. There are issues. You know, the sun varies, the region of space the solar system is in varies. I mean, there are a number of issues like that.
Yeah, that most people don't think about.
Those aren't, you know, as they pointed out, those aren't the primary things with the Ice Age, as they explain in the book. But humans have thought about a number of those things, and even if they aren't the primary explanation for the Ice Ages, they do have an impact on the history of the planet.
I was digressing.
No, that's fine. And but the deal here with the Andonites, you know, is you can tell from what they're saying there. Okay, they're, because they're driven to the geographic margins, they're not going to get totally, at least culturally, absorbed. They will stand apart, you know, right up till today. And so you ought to be able to, for instance, when they say, it's like, well, it looks like the biggie place is they held the northlands of the Eurasian continent. It's like, okay, so I should be able to go up to those northern regions of Europe and Asia, and I should see some significant language group that's not Indo-European, that's predicated on Andonite peoples being there, you know, and having a fundamentally different language influence than the Indo-European. And you go up there, and sure enough, you do. That whole Finno-Ugric language group. Right, it's just immediately obvious. Oh, that's different because that's, you know, are foundationally Andonite, whereas Indo-European is Andite. It's just, yeah, I mean, they don't have to tell you that. It's just immediately obvious. That's what's going on with the Finno-Ugric language group. All those northern peoples up there.
Yeah, they're mostly lily white.
Yeah. You know, and the degree to which they came down and took over Hungary, you know, you got the Hungarian language is, you know, it's not Indo-European. So see, that's so you now know what that is. That's Andonite. I mean, obviously it's evolved and whatnot, but foundationally, it's not Indo-European, and linguists can tell that. It's like, well, what is it? Why is it different? It's because the Andites were just marginalized and, didn't get blended in. And so they held a cultural... See, even when they're genetically, they start to get blended in more recent times, the culture influence endures. The language is still different. Okay, and then they give us just a couple little tidbits about the primary Sangiks here, because we're going to get extensive discussion of them as we go forward in subsequent papers. But what are their little thumbnail comments here?
Number four, the red man occupied the Americas, having been driven out of Asia over 50,000 years before the arrival of Adam.
Okay, so that's... do you remember how they kind of tossed out the 85,000 years ago thing back when we read about red men? They give you a little bit more details than kind of just a mean sort of a number like that. So here you see, so driven out of Asia over 50,000 years before the arrival of Adam. Okay, so in other words, that's like 88,000 years ago. Because if you remember, if you flip back, I keep tossing these things out. I should remind you, where you can go back and get that. The very first thing they say at the beginning of paper 74 is Adam and Eve arrived on Urantia from the year AD 1934, 37,848 years ago. All right, so you can either convert that to BC as 35,915 BC, or you can take it as years ago like that. So if it's over 50,000 years, it's like, well, okay, 88,000 years ago or a little more, okay, is apparently when they started being driven off, right? And then I wonder if they'll tell us at some point, when the last pure... The last pure ones are driven off. They will as we go forward a little bit. But see, here they're giving you, they began to be driven off a little bit before 85,000 years ago. Okay. Something like, more like 88. All right, so... So see, the more you want to get into these precise details about, you've got to look at all these places in the book. There's these little parts of it you got to put all together. If you want to get scientific, about this and try to, pin this down more precisely to archaeological evidence or whatever. They rarely give you everything you need in all in one spot. You've got to put the pieces together. And then figure out how the pieces fit together even, because there's a lot of times they're so vague about it because they're not allowed to say things very directly a lot of times. So you've got to reflect on it and figure out, oh, this is the beginning of it, okay, and that's the end of it, etc. You've got to sort it out like that. Otherwise, if you think about it simplistically, it just seems like you've got conflicts. But if you look closely, there is no conflict. They're telling a complex story. With simple statements.
One of their best ones was, Andon and Fontan wanted to send greetings, but they weren't allowed
to. wisely denied, yes. It's like, but I want them. Oh, that means I'm not so wise. Dang it. Okay, so yeah, see, just that tiny little thing, because it'll give us a lot more about the red man later in the story here.
Number five, the yellow race. The Chinese peoples were well established in control of Eastern Asia. Their most advanced settlements were situated to the northwest of modern China in regions bordering on Tibet.
Now, again, remember, we're back at the beginning of the 20th century. This is well before the People's Republic. Right? Okay, so Tibet is not part of China. Tibet you know, we still have free Tibet. You know, Tibet still, you know, wants to not be part of China. So what are they talking about? Situated to the, you know, you have that main region of the Sons of Han, you know, to the east. So if you go northeast from that, immediately on the north side of Tibet, you know, they're saying they had their most advanced settlements there back then, you know, not, you know, further to the east. Yeah, we'll get to that part of the story. That's very important. That's the Tarim Basin there, north, you know, in the Sinkiang province, north of Tibet. So you have these most advanced settlements. Those would be the most intriguing for Andites to engage and blend into. We'll get that story later on. Okay, what do they say about the blue race?
Number six, the blue race. The blue men were scattered all over Europe, but their better centers of culture were situated in the then fertile valleys of the Mediterranean basin and in northwestern Europe. Neanderthal absorption had greatly retarded the culture of the blue man, but he was otherwise the most aggressive, adventurous, and exploratory of all the evolutionary peoples of Eurasia.
Okay, we already talked a bit about that because we went through the whole Neanderthal thing. Remember, these these Neanderthals are before what current scientists call Neanderthals. They call blue men blended together with Neanderthals, Neanderthals. You have that purified Andonite stock that goes forward as what the Revelators call those original Neanderthals. And if it was that original purified stock, you wouldn't have this had greatly retarded the culture. But remember, you know, long span of time goes by before Blue Man gets there. And so they've begun to backmate again. You know, so by the even though the blue men are not mating with the most backmated ones, there's a degree of backmating nonetheless. On top of, even if there was no backmating at all, right, the Andonites are not as advanced a people as the Sangiks. Okay. So they're blending in a lot of Andonite, which would diminish things even in the best of circumstances. But it's also, there's a bit of backmating, even in the best of the Neanderthals. And we talked about that. That's why you can have a lot of body hair in, you know, in some of those peoples in Europe that you don't, you know, the Sangiks don't really have much in the way of body hair. It's like, well, where did the body hair come from? It didn't come from Adamites. It didn't come from the Sangiks. It's like, well, and it didn't come from pure Andonites either. Where did it come from? It's that backmating that brings in those things in Europe.
Where are the fertile valleys of the Mediterranean?
Oh, okay. So, yeah, we're going to get to that in number nine here, you know, more directly. But, see the Mediterranean basin, and we're about to get to that. Right, there was a Mediterranean basin back then, not the Mediterranean Sea like we have right now. That's coming up in a second.
That was after
the flooded. We'll explain that in a second. Let's wait till we get to number nine, and we'll explain the details of that. Right, but we're talking about what's now not land. So blue men, was living in a lot of places where there's no land right now. That's what they're telling you there. It's underwater now. Let's see, anything else there? Just that I should mention, you're obviously going to have, you know, we saw that the Andonites were pushed way up to the northern margins there in northern Europe. And so you'll have some boundary mixing of blue man into those northern people. So even if their language is basically Andonite, don't be surprised if there isn't some what we now call Mongoloid-like features, you know, red man, yellow man, blue man is the same way, like features that can be up there so that you can, if you can have that in some of those northern European peoples, if there's been some blending in of that little bit more blue man's primary Sangic stock, you know, they might have a little bit of you know, what we think of as yellow man sort of features, like their eyes or whatnot. Okay. So besides skin color maybe sometimes being a little red or a little yellow up there, you might actually get a little bit of, you know, what we think of as yellow man-like features. And it isn't just because of the yellow man. It's, don't forget, the blue man is a primary Sangic also. Right? And can, you know, you can have some Laplander, you know, influence that blends in. Okay, so just, you know, that's very complicated up there. All right, now what about the secondary Sangics? And I'm going to give you a little bit about them.
Quick question.
Oh, yeah.
Why do they use, for red man, they say the red man, and
oh.
For yellow and blue, they say the yellow race and blue race?
They'll mix them up, but, you know, but just think about how, we have a, you know, at the time this was written, you had a fairly definitive concept of red man, you know, spoken of that way. You definitely don't have blue man, right? Humans don't use that term. And you don't really, you know, you don't very often say yellow man, you'll just say Chinese. Right. So they're doing that to remind you that because red man was so separated in North America, you actually end up having, even in, you know, say the 19th century and early 20th century, having it very natural to speak of them as red man. In the way, you know, the Rancho book talks about, you know, red man, blue man, yellow man, green man, whatnot. You know, we actually use that term red man. So they're just, you know, they're just reminding you of how we use the language in that way. So that's why they said, they didn't say the same, you know, I mean, obviously the most generalized way would be the red race, yellow race, blue race, different races, but they don't, you know, we call, you know, we definitely call them red men. Okay, so that's why they're doing that.
Number 7, pre-Dravidian India. The complex mixture of races in India, embracing every race on earth, but especially the green, orange, and black, maintained a culture slightly above that of the outlying regions.
Okay, so a couple things there. We'll get to the whole Dravidian thing in detail. But what that means is pre-Andite India. Okay, just think of it that way right now. So before, you know, you really had any Andite influence in India, you just had the Sangic stocks there. You had them all, you had all the races there, but they're pointing out that you ended up with a lot of the secondary Sangics there. And notice that they don't say green, orange, indigo. Okay. You know, remember how the way it normally works is the green and orange left the homeland region first and went places. And indigo was the last to leave the Sangic homelands. And so as the indigo heads into regions where orange and green went, they're immediately dominating and absorbing them. And so before they go very far, you don't have indigo, you have black. Right? Because the combination of orange, green, and indigo is black man. Right? And so that's why they're saying you had green and orange going in there, but you know, by the time the indigo got there, they weren't really indigo, they were black, they had absorbed the orange and the green, just like they did so much when they went to Africa. Right? Orange went first, and green went and conquered Orange Man, and blended in some orange, the orange and green together, and then the indigo went there and, you know, and immediately dominated the green and absorbed that green and orange, and, you know, and you had black man. But then a lot more indigo went in on top of that, which we'll see here in a second. Okay, but you know, black and indigo aren't synonyms. If they say black, they mean black. They mean the blend of the three secondary sangics. They're just talking about indigo, they'll say indigo. Okay. And that blending of the three is helpful. Right? The three secondary sangics together is a more significant race than any one of the three secondaries by themselves. So they maintained a culture slightly above the outlying regions. And then you throw in some, you know, a little bit of primary sangic too, and that isn't, you know, that doesn't hurt, you know, to having it cut above also. But you know, you definitely have a more balanced mind when you've got the three secondaries blended together. Is there someone asking something? Oh, okay. All right, and then like I was saying, notice what they do here in this next one.
Number eight, the Sahara civilization. The superior elements of the indigo race had their most progressive settlements in what is now the Great Sahara Desert. This indigo black group carried extensive strains of the submerged orange and green races.
Okay, so what they're talking about here, see, is pre-Sahara Desert. Okay, they'll talk about that, you know, the details later, but see, it's in the wake of the ice leaving the continent that things changed, and that in northern Africa turned into a desert. You know, but before the ice age ended, you know, it was a wonderful, fertile place to live, and a lot of people lived there. There was a whole civilization there, the Sahara civilization. And see, they talk about indigo going, okay, but like I was just saying, remember the orange went first and then the green. And so you got black man kind of there initially, but then more indigo streams in on top of that. See, so you have indigo hyphen black, right? Black is the foundation with pure indigo built upon top that foundation. And so that's why when you go there, you know, you can find a lot of very indigo-toned people because there's a lot of indigo that went in there. So, you know, even if there's a black foundation, you know, you can still end up with a quite indigo skin color. But you can also, you know, find someone who's got pretty orange skin too, you know, in pockets. You know, not to mention very black people, right, that are just ebony-colored skin, right, to obviously have quite an equal blend of the three secondary sangics to get such ebony-colored skin like that. Okay, so, like I said, see, indigo and black are obviously not synonyms, or indigo hyphen black would be silly. Right? Right. They're not synonyms. Yeah, we mindlessly call anyone that has dark skin black, right? But the revelators are not doing that. So like I said, that you have that as one of the big things that changed when the Ice Age ended, is that you've got the Sahara Desert there. And the other big thing is in number nine here.
Number nine, the Mediterranean Basin. the most highly blended race outside of India, occupied what is now the Mediterranean basin. Here, blue men from the north and Saharans from the south met and mingled with Nadites and Adamites from the east.
Okay, so other than the Kutch Basin of India, where kind of everyone that drifted that way fell down into the pocket of the subcontinent of India and you got them all pooled together, this, you know, instead of a north-south pocket to catch them, you have a literal elevation pocket, the Mediterranean basin, basically caught all the different races too. And so back in the day, remember, we've already talked about this, that you know, a little less than 4,000 years after they left the first garden, the peninsula sunk under the waters. Okay, so, you know, they'll explain that more. You know, we got the little hint about the Sicilian land bridge back there when they talked about it, but they're going to give you more explanation. But what happened is, so way back when there was lots of ice and everything was lower, you had two inland seas, right, on each side of the Sicilian land bridge. And as long as Gibraltar was sealed, right, the Atlantic Ocean couldn't get in. But not only did you have water rising, but they tell you later there was a big earthquake that broke Gibraltar. And so in comes the rising Atlantic Ocean. And so the West Basin filled up first. You know, and just imagine the calamity, right? If this was a highly populated region, that basin.
Wasn't that before Adam and
Eve? Yes, right. But just, right, but, I mean, there was things that happened there, you know, but, you know, way back in ancient, you know, historical geology times. Okay, but as I point out, I mean, you know, like I said, it was, so you had the Western Basin filling in because Gibraltar broke, and eventually the ocean rises enough that it goes over the Sicilian land bridge. Okay, and that's where where the story comes in, as we just read about Adam and Eve, that you know, once the ocean rises up and goes over into the East Basin across the, you know, and the Sicilian land bridge goes under, that's when the first garden went under. Okay, so let's think about that. I mean, if it's a little under 4,000 years, where does that put us? Well, that puts us about 34,000 years ago then is when the first garden submerged.
It took a while for the water to get over there. About that accident.
Right, but think about it. I mean, if you put everything together, so you have the first garden submerging about 34,000 years ago. What did they just tell you up front here? Remember, the ice age ended about 35,000 years ago. See, so in other words, you know, about 1,000 years after, you know, there was any sort of, you know, everything, you know, 1,000 years after everything was definitively receding. Right, the ocean had risen enough to swamp the first garden.
Interesting.
Okay, and there continued to be ocean rise. I mean, it wasn't until don't they say it's something like 5500 BC or something like that when it finally got deep enough in the eastern basin to flow up the Bosphorus and fill up the Black Sea. See, so it's right there at the beginning of recorded history that you finally completed filling that all in and going all the way and filling in the Black Sea. And so that just reminds you of just how much the oceans have risen. See? They're reminding you that there's going to be a little bit of time before before the first garden sinks. In other words, before the Mediterranean basically fills up, that you will have Adamites going into the peoples that are in the Mediterranean basin there. It's not going to be for very long because of it filling up. Just like it's not going to be very long that they're going to be, you know, engaging the Saharan civilization, because so at the same time that you're filling in the Mediterranean, it's going to the Sahara Desert. Those are kind of happening at the same time because they're both tied to the end of the Ice Age. You know, and the climate radically changing because of that. You know, the prevailing winds are very different and all this sort of stuff. Yeah, ocean currents, all kinds of things. You know, everything is, you know, very, and that again, you know, gets back to, you know, I mean, again, why is it that recorded history starts at about 6,000 BC? It's because that's when things had very much settled down with the climate, and for the last 8,000 years, it's been a relatively, or at least 7,000 years, has been a relatively mild, stable climate so that civilization could get going, right? And like, but that's not the history of the planet, right? That's this little
I don't know, it depends what religion you are.
Yes. You know, it's this little window of salubriousness, right? Relative salubriousness that you can easily be delusional about, right, and falsely expand that to think that that's the way it's always been and that's the way it's always going to be. You know, not so. And once humans have the technology to deal with change, right, don't be surprised if the Earth starts changing again. I mean, who knows how many things have to change with the sun and stuff. I mean, you know, eventually they're going to encircle the sun, but are there evolutionary things with the sun that have to go on before they can do that, or before they will do that, or who knows, right? I mean, and again, the slightest change in the sun, right, is going to, you know, produce all kinds of changes in our climate. So, we remember, if there isn't tribulation, there's no potential for wisdom, right? So, you know. But you had to have a relatively calm climate to get things established. But once you, now that we have our sea legs, right? All right, tribulation is going to be coming our way, right? Because wisdom is the watchword, right? We've got a lot of wisdom to acquire between now and light and life. Okay, so that's the deal there. That those the 8 and 9 are relatively short-term things relative to the Adamites because we're right there, you know, in the wake of 35,000 years ago with the Ice Age coming to an end. Okay, what else do they say here?
This was the picture of the world prior to the beginnings of the great expansions of the Violet Race, about 25,000 years ago. The hope of future civilization lay in the second garden between the rivers of Mesopotamia. Here in southwestern Asia, there existed the potential of a great civilization, the possibility of the spread to the world of the ideas and ideals which had been salvaged from the days of Dalmatia and the times of Eden.
Okay, so giving you a little hint about, as they lay out this story, there's going to be something significant about in the ballpark of 25,000 years ago, but as we do, you know, obviously, the Sahara civilization and the Mediterranean basin stuff is long gone by the time you get to 25,000 years ago. See? Right, so it's just in the very beginning stages that you have that geographic situation there. Let's see, anything else there? Other than just. When they, you know, the hope of future civilization, again, because it's impossible for even the best of the primary Sanghiks to produce much in the way of civilization. And I mean, any relatively non-primitive civilization requires the Adamic uplift. Because civilization is founded on your relationship to the Holy Spirit, and your relationship to the Holy Spirit is founded on you can get engagement by the seventh adjutant. And so if you don't upstep the seventh adjutant encirclement in mankind, you just can't get very much to the Holy Spirit. And you really can't get to civilization. In the contrast of that, the hope of future civilization. Remember what they said before this list started. They said, but most of Urantia languished in savagery. Right? Not barbarism. Savagery. Right? So in other words, it's just marginally human. Right? I mean, to say savage is to basically say the human is negligible. It's just a fancy animal. So you have something that, you know, is its natural state is basically animal. So if there's going to be any civilization, any humanity, you need this little precious amount of Adamic blood, right?
So barbaric is even higher than savage.
Yeah, savage is the most primitive, and then barbaric, and then civilized, or maybe semi-civilized, and then civilized. Yeah. But yeah, that's the terminology that humans coined, and the revelators are using it in that spectrum. When you have rudimentary human behavior, that's barbaric. Most of religion on the planet is barbaric now. It's not savage. Because there's been a lot of... Most religion is barbaric. Because there's been a lot of
revelation.
Yeah, remember they say it's like, well, okay, maybe some of you call sort of marginally semi-civilized, right? But, I mean, and that's just because they've adopted a little bit more of the revelatory influence. But basically, the revelation up to this point has taken it from... religion from savage to barbaric. When we get to the evolution of religions, we'll see him, you know, explaining that. Okay. Let's see, anything else there? Just maybe notice the precision that they toss in there. The possibility of the spread to the world of the ideas and ideals, see, both. And which is the root one? Ideals. Right, so the ideas are approached from the top down, right? To get up and get a hold of ideals and then have downstepped expressions of those ideals as ideas that engage the specifics of the world around you. Right, top-down people, right? the possibility of top-down people, right, is, you know, has this tentative grip on existence there between the rivers. Okay, and the last little statement here.
Adam and Eve had left behind a limited but potent progeny, and the celestial observers on Urantia waited anxiously to find out how these descendants of the erring material son and daughter would acquit themselves.
Everyone was on the edge of their seats. Anxiously. You know how Jesus analogized this limited but potent? What analogy did he use? Some little thing that grows into a big thing. A mustard seed, yes. Right. Right. That's the mustard seed. You know, think about, you know, a little bit of spiritual juicing, if you will, goes a long way. Because it brings in a geometric instead of merely an arithmetic influence. Right, so, thank goodness for that fact about, you know, about spiritualized mind, that it has that mustard seed nature. Because if it was arithmetic, the default would have meant the end.
Yeah.
Right. The numbers are just too small arithmetically. No way. Okay, we can get a little bit more here, I think.
Section 2, the Adamites in the Second Garden. For thousands of years, the sons of Adam labored along the rivers of Mesopotamia, working out their irrigation and flood control problems to the south, perfecting their defenses to the north, and attempting to preserve their traditions of the glory of the first Eden.
So, obviously you can read between the lines there. Migration would be just minor to begin with. They're pretty much staying put. But you know, it wasn't zero, because they already mentioned there that the Mediterranean basin had Nodites and Adamites from the east. So there wasn't huge waves going out in those first few thousand years before the basin filled up. But there was some. But mostly they were not, for the very beginning, they were trying to build up a significant maintainable position there between the rivers. You notice that they're, we've got working out their integration and flood control problems and all these issues of the vicissitudes of that geographic location. Make sure that they can get fully on top of them so that for thousands and thousands and thousands of years they can maintain themselves there as an ongoing source of millions and millions of Adamites going out to the surrounding peoples. Right, this place has to support, many, 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 many generations, right, to produce millions and millions and millions and millions of people. They won't all be living there, but they have to get a very stable situation set up. And they've got an endless onslaught of savages, like we were just talking, right? So these perfecting their defenses to the north. I mean, every year, right, they would have been beset by savages for millennia after millennia, right? Year in, year out. So think of how committed they have to be, right, to this. That you wouldn't just say, I give up, let the flood tides wash over us. Just how tedious that would be. This is the 20,000th year of savage attacks. Don't underestimate the Mad Max character of what was outside that little triangle that they mentioned. Because again, it's not just the fact that they're innately savages. Those savages are constantly being animated by the prince and his staff and all of their foolishness, right? All the rebels are going to be constantly working to try to make sure that the savages give them no peace. You really hate those people over there, don't you? Yeah, you do, don't you? Yeah, I think you should rise up against them. You've only done it 6 times this year. We should go for a 7th this year. Right? They would just be constantly prodding them to beset, the second garden.
Well, and those are the kinds of minds they could do that with easily.
Yeah. You got all these rebel secondary midwares, right, that could easily be engaging all these people and stirring them up. Right, so just get rid of your pictures of some idyllic Kavona like place here. Right? This is rough stuff, right? Yep.
I think of the immigration problem kind of as a parallel to sweeping over with ignorance, whole sections of Europe.
The book tells you point blank. That would be very foolish to just mate everyone uniformly on the planet. This tiny little bit of Adamic blood you have can easily be diluted too far, and there won't be any civilization, right? And no way to magically, get it back. Once you don't have civilizable people, there's never going to be civilization again. We're supposed to take heart in the fact that they said it was potent. Right? Not only does a little go a long way, but that little bit can endure basically endlessly, as the garden, you know, second garden dwellers are demonstrating here historically, right? That, you know, it won't be overwhelmed. I mean, you can think about how difficult it would be to actually conquer the United States, like a lot of Sangic peoples in the world delusionally think that they might do. Think about how tough that really would be to actually overcome that Andite blood, right? The Sangics don't understand just, you know, how long you can hold, you know, when you've got that Andite, you know, you know, arrow inside of you, right?
So that goes for European countries too?
Well, most of the Andite blood, though, left Europe and came here. That's the whole point of the United States. The more Andite upstepped peoples wanted to head for the horizon, right? So the, you know, that's why Europe is, you know, that's why the United States has to go over and save Europe so frequently, like Thomas Jefferson said that we would. I mean, because that's they're you know, it's not like there isn't any Andite blood there, but you know, it's in relative terms, it's more Sangic there, more place-like, less direction-like. You know, you can see it in the three Scandinavian countries. Right? You know, you'd think, well, that's got to be where the most Andite blood is. Well, but most of it came over here. You know, of the three, the headquarters location for the Northern White race, Denmark, right, is you know, still remains the most directional of the three peoples. The Norwegians and the Swedes now are quite place-like. But the Danes, you can still get to actually fight. Right? If there's a battle that needs to be fought by NATO, you can get the Danes to send some troops, but it's very difficult to get the Norwegians or the Swedes to send any troops. Right? and it's just, you know, it's because that's where the headquarters was. That's the cream of the, you know, the Andite genetics, you know, is still there. You can still see it in the culture today of those three nations. So, you know, there's some there. You know, we all know that why we have such a close tie with Great Britain, right? Because you've got some, you have some directionality there still, but the, you know, if, you know, and if not, if it's not genetics, it's just culture. The Sangic culture is just kind of insidiously oozing into the pores of everyone, you know, and so even Great Britain, you know, and now us are starting to languish under these desires to just kind of puddle, you know, into a place like people and not be a directional people anymore, right? To, you know, the Sangic voice says a future time orientation is racist, right? Yeah. See, that's a recognition that there is a race of people that were directional, the Andites, and the other races, the Sangics, and the Andonites, are place-like more. Not directional. It literally, you know, there is a recognition on, you know, ignorantly, that it is a racial issue. The Adamites are what gave us a directional sense. And, you know, it's not skin, you know, and when all is, like I was saying, when all is said and done, it transcends skin color, just like the cultural influences lasted longer than the genetics. Right? And so, even if you can't keep the genetics going, you have to keep that cultural influence going, that directional culture. And you can't get sucked into that place-like mentality about a culture. You know, let me just lay here and wait for some benevolent, you know, being to drop a date into my mouth. You know, maybe I should get up off my back and go do something with my life. Right, that directional sense. Right, yes, right. The Sangics can get the being part, but it takes some Andite blood to get the doing part. Okay, let's keep going here. We did the first paragraph, right? So, yep, next.
The heroism displayed in the leadership of the Second Garden constitutes one of the amazing and inspiring epics of Urantia's history. These splendid souls never wholly lost sight of the purpose of the Adamic mission, and therefore did they valiantly fight off the influences of the surrounding and inferior tribes, while they willingly sent forth their choicest sons and daughters in a steady stream as emissaries to the races of Earth. Sometimes this expansion was depleting to the home culture, but always these superior peoples would rehabilitate themselves.
So there's a little vignette, see,
yeah,
of how it's supposed to be done. Very directly there. Again, splendid souls, okay? They mean souls. Right, there's a significant upper domain in the hourglass analogy, right, and that definitive directional fact is amazing and inspiring. Right, they never wholly lost sight of the purpose. Right, it takes a person to consciousize purpose. Right, your personality is your purposing influence. Right. So they valiantly fought off, right? You got to fight for this, right? You can't be the golden rulers that are exterminated by the baser orders of humanity, right? Golden ruler, yes, but not a self-destructive golden ruler. They weren't self-destructive golden rulers. They valiantly fought off the influences of surrounding and inferior tribes. Right. It's totally politically incorrect to say such things, but that's the facts. See, while they willingly, right, they have actual personality, they have will, and sent forth their choicest, right, personality, individuals who can choose, don't just make decisions, but actual choices, real choices.
Paragraph again.
Right, just look at the words they've selected. Right, they're talking about humans, not fancy animals. They are, transcendently altruistic, right? They send forth their choicest sons and daughters, right, to the point where they're kind of hanging on by their fingernails culturally because the cream of the crop is, gone off and blended in, right? But, remember, it's the middle peoples that have the real regenerative potential, like they tell you. So you can send off the leading tail of the bell curve, but that leading tail will be regenerated by the center of the bell curve, right? But always these superior peoples would rehabilitate themselves. So it's all there, just one glorious paragraph, right? It has to be that way. If it isn't, right, it's all lost. And because it's showing signs of going in that unfortunate direction, that's why this book is in my lap. As I say all the time, there's a civilizational emergency because we're not thinking like this. We're thinking like the golden rulers that get exterminated by the baser orders of humanity. And wouldn't it be horrific if the only solution is for the divine executioner to exterminate all of the baser orders of humanity before your eyes? Do you want that solution? And because they're going to make, we will get the light and life one way or another. That would be a very harsh solution to just have the divine executioner eliminate hundreds of millions of people from the planet in a snap of his finger.
Who's the divine executioner?
the divine executioner, the ancients of days, right? Oh. Right, they tell you if they have to call in all of the master physical controllers, they will. They can order them to do whatever.
Doesn't mean they don't necessarily go to the mansion.
Right? And you know, besides that paragraph that I'm referring to about the divine executioners and doing, are you sure that it's okay to do that? Remember, they say that. Right? Then they tell you that the angels of nation life really are the angels of the trumpets. Right? Right? Now, and if they decide that, you know, remember, to get to light and life, you have to have definitive nations. Right? That's indispensable to the fact of a world of enlightened life, solid nations, right? You know, there's all kinds of people on the planet think nations are evil and need to be washed away. Right? I mean, the angels of nation life that oversee the integrity of nations, you know, those nucleuses of, you know, or the atoms, if you will, of the molecules of the world enlightened life, right? If they think that's fundamentally in jeopardy, they have trumpets. Right? They can call on the divine executioners or the most high regent or whatever to do whatever is required, no matter how extreme, to see to it that comes to pass. So, I mean, the book is very harsh about this. It's like, if you should be a golden ruler, but you can't be a self-destructive golden ruler. And if you are, those harsh measures will play out. Those things that you think would be so horrible, right? And you want to be so tender-hearted, quote-unquote, it's like, no, you can take that to an extreme where, you know, humans won't be the authors of, you know, mass genocide. God will. And that's a very harsh statement in the book, right? I talk about it all the time. I mean, to even hint at that there's some truth flowing through the harsh things that are in the book of Revelations. Right? They tell you factually, okay, it's a story. But for them to say that there's a truth there isn't anything more extreme that you could possibly say. There isn't anything more extreme that you could possibly say, that there are really angels of the trumpets. Right? So, I mean, I try to stress this. And we need to wake up to what they're saying here.
Except them not.
Right. Right? You don't want to go there, right?
But we might need that solution.
That may be the only path. If it is, even though he slay me, yet will I serve him. You have to say that to yourself, right? But, I mean, obviously, they've given us this book because they recognize that there's at least a potential for it to not go that way. If they could see no way, they wouldn't have wasted their time giving us this book, right? But it's obviously doesn't have to go that way.
At least we know rogue midwayers to contend with anymore.
Right.
You know, that stuff.
Right.
Rogue anything.
Right. All we have right now to contend with is our profound free will ignorance. There's none so blind as those who will not see. You know, that we're blinding ourselves freely of our own free will, right? And that's the emergency.
It's all for the supreme. I know one planet has to like totally go down that for the fullness of the supreme, but
It's obviously not foreordained, right? I mean, or the book wouldn't be like I just said. So, I mean, there's hope, right? But there's rugged facts, okay, in play. They make sure we recognize this to sober us, to clear our heads of any, you know, illusions or delusions. I know it can be kind of harsh and scary to talk about those things, but it's important to remind yourself of that, the Revelator said, I think it's time that they're told the facts. You know, they're not little kids. They can handle it. Let's tell them. Right? What's in play? And maybe they can take the light in cultivating again.
Very heartening. Always these superior peoples will rehabilitate themselves. Hopefully they're referring to us. That's the segment of us.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, again, if it was a zero possibility, the book wouldn't be here. So, you can take... you can take heart in that fact. But it's not going to happen, you know, because you used a book as a pillow, right, or a doorstop. You're going to have to, you know, really face the facts, right, of the book. Okay, what else do they say here?
The civilization, society, and cultural status of the Adamites were far above the general level of the evolutionary races of Urantia. Only among the old settlements of Van and Amadon and the Adamsonites was there a civilization in any way comparable. But the civilization of the Second Eden was an artificial structure. It had not been evolved, and was therefore doomed to deteriorate until it reached a natural evolutionary level.
Okay, so there is an interesting, see, paragraph about this natural, unnatural thing that we talk about all the time. So look at, you know, what they're pointing out. Way back then, right, I mean, you're not quivering on the very brink way back then, right, of transitioning into the, you know, the second, you know, set of developmental epochs, right? You're working through nutrition epoch, security age, you know, it's material comfort era, right? It's inescapably naturally dominant, even with the amount of personal ability that the Adamites have. You're not going to maintain something unnatural. It's just too natural. But, as I point out all the time, the whole point now is, right, we have the opportunity to begin to move into the quest for knowledge and wisdom, you know, and beyond that, where more and more we are using our free will to transcend the natural state of affairs, right? And a civilization enlightened life is wholly unnatural. Okay. So, but way back then, even with, you know, pure Adamites and all that, you're not there yet. You know, you are inescapably part of a natural evolutionary, you know, system that lifespans, you know, go down to 70 years or by reason of strength 80 and everything else like we've talked about, and notice that they even have civilization, society, and cultural status. They have all three, you know, getting you thinking about that difference between society, culture, and civilization, like we've talked about. Then the other thing, again, is just stressing, you know, so I keep stressing it, far above the general level. Okay, so, it harkens back again to when they said savage there back at the beginning. There's a lot of tendency these days to think that that there's an emergency that requires some sort of radical, you know, cultural response because of very primitive, you know, i.e. savage-like mentality. No, that's not the emergency. I mean, but, you know, they're trying to remind you here, you have no idea what savage is like, right? Back then, you had this tiny little triangle, basically, and everything else was savage in a way that you can hardly even imagine. Okay, the entire planet was like that, and that wasn't an emergency. And there wasn't an emergency revelation because of that. Right? So, you know, to challenge your spiritual consciousness that wants to assume that's what the emergency is. That's not the emergency. It's the opposite. The person that looks out and sees the savages and thinks they're an emergency, no.
Yeah.
Right. The only one that can produce an emergency is someone who is unfortunately using their free will. Right. It's Those who can't see is not an emergency. Those who will not see, that's an emergency.
Yeah.
And so again, like I say all the time, we finally have actualized the fruits of the spiritual uplift 2,000 years ago to the point where the double-edged sword is finally in play. And in our ignorance, we're using the wrong blade. Okay? We're using the blade that destroys ourself, not the blade that cuts forward through the fog, right, and brings enlightenment into the void. We're using the backward-cutting blade. That's the emergency.
You made the good point that through our ignorance.
Yeah.
We sit here with the luxury of revelation in our life.
Yeah.
You've just been saying.
Yeah.
But most of the world does not.
And yeah.
You keep on saying it's in our lap. Right. You know, every time you say that, I say, damn it, I got to get it out of the lap. At least in some of the hands of the people that are, as you say, you know, maybe moving forward or wanting to move forward.
Those that have
not, you know, I mean, let's face it, a lot of us here have been reading this book for a long time, and then when you first get into it, or get into it to an extent that it does something to your life or builds up extra knowledge in your life, you may not get into it to the depth you do in a class like this, but it still does a lot to be able to give you that consciousness, I think you're talking about, that, you know, makes you be able to get beyond just the spiritual zeal side and into the wisdom side of things to make those kinds of decisions going forward.
Yeah, and again,
and it's not us versus them.
Just like with the fourth epical revelation, you know, what the people of the world needed was not people walking out, you know, to the ends of the earth from Palestine with a book of what Jesus said. Right? What the world needed was people walking out from Palestine who embodied the faith of Jesus, right? And the same thing is here. I mean, what the world really needs is people that walk out from the revelation, embodying the truth of the revelation. Right? The world needs the truth that you could embody, not the book directly. I mean, the book is required to get people, you know, to embody that truth, obviously, right? But remember that the whole point is, you know, ultimately is not to spread the book, but to spread the truth embodied in cosmic conscious citizens. Right? So you can do just like they're doing here. You know, you know, what they're basically doing there is setting up a parallel culture. Right in that little triangle. You've got the main evolutionary stream of culture on the planet, and they set up a little parallel stream of culture. Right? And from that parallel stream, they fed into the main evolutionary stream, the uplift. See, because that's the only way to do it. When a dispensational revelation fails, the only thing that you can do is to get into the parallel stream model. And Melchizedek tried to set up, you know, or he did. He set up the parallel stream model. This is trying to set up the parallel stream model. The idea is to have a parallel stream of people who are engaging the book very directly, right, and coming to embody the truth that it can awaken within you, the relationship to truth that it can awaken within you. And then those people go out, the choicest sons and daughters, go out in a steady stream to the main evolutionary stream and uplift it. That's the only way to preserve the potential future of the main evolutionary stream, is to have that parallel stream that is conserving, right, the truths.
It doesn't look like we have much of a parallel.
Right. But it helps to know that that's what you're supposed to do, and rather than thinking, well, what we're supposed to do is just go out and just diffuse it. No, you're supposed to be setting up, think in that parallel terms. That's what we're supposed to be doing, just like they did here. You know, and it took them a long time to get a solid parallel stream set up. Right? It's going to be the same thing now.
I just looked it up in Spanish, and there are a lot of Spanish-speaking people that are connecting together
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, you know, some of it is just going to go into the evolutionary stream, main evolutionary stream, and tweak it a little bit. But there has to be, yeah, because Machaventa did two things, right? He had Abraham to try to kind of just solidify the main evolutionary stream a little bit, but he also set up the parallel stream with the Kenites. Right? And the Kenites, the parallel stream doesn't get recorded in history. Right, the main evolutionary stream gets recorded in history. Moses seems to come out of nowhere, right, in recorded history. But you got the whole thing. You literally tried to get it from from Adam to Abraham. You know, all. I mean, it's you got this whole fixation on the main evolutionary stream. And no recognition that the only reason that there could be this great leader that could step into that stream, Moses, because he set up that parallel stream. Yep.
The Adamites have something significant to teach us, I think, about the proper relationship to spirit, because they didn't at all wishy-washy.
Right, look at the material pragmatism that they had, yes.
Even though they're forward-looking people,
yep,
they were dedicated to preserving traditions,
right,
and maintaining this integrity of what they had.
Right. So, right. They had ideas and ideals.
Yeah.
See? They had material consciousness and spiritual consciousness.
We need to watch out for wanting to improve on the Urantia book. Finding errors in it. Dismembering it because it doesn't seem to work all together quite like we think it should.
That's what a defeated golden ruler looks like. Somebody wants to change the book or something like that. What?
All right, let's keep going here.
Yeah, we can finish this
page. Yep. Let's finish this section here.
Adam left a great intellectual and spiritual culture.
Oh, did we? Oh, yeah, we did. We did. Oh, I'm all right. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
It had not been evolved in
IT. I forgot that I needed to highlight that. All right. Yeah. So before you go, go on. Just notice that they italicized that it had not been evolved. I just wanted to stress that with the whole natural unnatural thing that we're talking about. Coming back to that. It's related to what Gene was just saying about the spiritual idealism and the material pragmatism. You have to have that material pragmatism consciousness, that material consciousness, so that you take into account the evolutionary facts, like they're highlighting there, italicizing there, right? So that you don't get into this over-existentialized way of thinking that's dominated by your spiritual consciousness, right? And don't take evolutionary facts into account. That's just, you know, why did they italicize that? That's the only thing we hadn't talked about yet, was why they italicized that. Okay.
Adam left a great intellectual and spiritual culture behind him. But it was not advanced in mechanical appliances, since every civilization is limited by available natural resources, inherent genius, and sufficient leisure to ensure inventive fruition. The civilization of the Violet Race was predicated on the presence of Adam and on the traditions of the first Eden. After Adam's death, and as these traditions grew dim through the passing millenniums, the cultural level of the Adamites steadily deteriorated until it reached a state of reciprocal balance with the status of the surrounding peoples and the naturally evolving cultural capacities of the Violet Race.
See, Violet Race is evolving too, see? Right, it doesn't start out fully evolved, right? So keep that in mind, that evolutionary fact. And then another thing there is, again, when they say about how it's far above, you're thinking, oh, it must be the psychedelic place. No, it's actually quite primitive from what we think. But that relatively primitive little triangle was far above. And again, how savage the rest of the world was. So that's clear, right?
This is mechanical appliances. I was thinking of the dishwasher.
Right, right. They didn't have fancy titanium anything, right? Right.
Unobtainium.
Yeah, it's all, you know, and very simple, you know, from our perspective. Yeah, and just, you know, noticing how it's such a rigorous life, you just don't have the leisure, right? Right? As they tell you, until you get a priestly class, you know, that's coddled, there wasn't people on the planet with enough leisure to actually get science going, right? So, on the one hand, thinking, wow, these worthless bums, you know, that are just mooching off of everyone else. Like, yes, but there needs to be that, right? The material comfort era, right? There has to get to the point where there can be some material comfort before, you know, you can just sit down and calmly focus and invent something.
Right? Just like with the stable climate.
Yep, right. Right. Yep, all that works together. Okay, but again, and it's going to all, you know, eventually blend down in. Okay, one little final thing here.
But the Adamites were a real nation around 19,000 BC, numbering 4.5 million, and already they had poured forth millions of their progeny into the surrounding peoples.
Okay, so another little anchor point that... you still had a very definitive Adamite nation in 19,000 BC. Not that long ago, see? With 4.5 million people. And they'd already poured forth millions. So, you know, you can tell from that, you know, in relative terms, it might have been small, those that went over to the Mediterranean basin, but yeah, there would have been quite a few. I mean, you had a few thousand years for them to be going over there. So a lot of generations, you know, before the Mediterranean basin filled up. So even in those initial low levels, you would have had a lot of people that went into the Mediterranean basin before it flooded.
Just think, with that many people, you know, if there wasn't a default, how much further along would it be? Yeah. I mean, today, you say all the time, wouldn't even recognize the
site. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so it reminds me, it may have been just a handful they started with, but see, they made sure they built it up. I mean, even that far down, to have that big a core still. So that's why there's someone that can read the words in this book on the planet, right? If it wasn't for that, if it wasn't for them having such solid material pragmatism, right, you know, if they'd just immediately gone chasing after fancy butterflies, right?
Yes,
right. They could focus and they could stay focused. Think about how many people that have some spiritual consciousness cannot focus, and even if they can focus, they can't hold it. You know, a month after, you know, a month later, it's like, well, no, I'm kind of interested in this over here now.
Yeah.
I was like, well, what happened to that great venture you started? I was like, well, you know, there's a fancier butterfly over there, you know. It's, you know, that's that unity consciousness being, you know, diffusing your mind. You've got to have some individuality consciousness to keep yourself focused. Okay.
Or the other answer is not went bankrupt.
Time for some wisdom.
Exactly.
Okay, so that's the preface. It's a great place to stop. You know, they've just kind of been giving you hints about dates, you know, like 19,000 BC and stuff. You know, they're now going to actually kind of get into a little bit more of a linear description of it as we go forward here. And you can see section 4 is when they formally introduce the Andites. So, all right, let's pause there for the evening. Take a moment, everyone.